I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
The LRB podcast is sponsored by Art and Ideas, a podcast series featuring J. Paul Getty Trust President Jim Cuno in conversation with artists, writers, curators and scholars. In the latest episode, Ankar Mühlstein, author of The Pen and the Brush, How Passion for Art Shaped 19th Century French Novels, discusses the symbiotic relationship between authors and artists in 19th century France. Search Getty Art and Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or other podcast sources.
Hello, and welcome to another London Review of Books podcast. I'm Tom Crewe. I'm joined today by William Davis, who is a reader in political economy at Goldsmiths, University of London. We're here to talk today about Will's piece about Corbyn, called Reasons for Corbyn. It was published 2 issues ago, which takes as its subject the influence of the internet on modern politics. And I think what's useful about Will's piece is that it actually allows us to explore a series of issues and themes that have been brought up in the LRB over the last year or so as we as a sort of paper try to get to grips with our current moment. My latest contribution to this is a piece in the new issue of the LRB about politics and the press and the possibility of a post-press politics. So we'll be talking about that as well. But I think we'll just start by talking about Will's first essay for the LRB, which was about Theresa May. It was a rather chilling piece about the sort of Home Office mentality and the way in which Brexit could enable a politics which discriminated between different sorts of people and different sorts of economic sectors.
Yes.
Maybe you could just, you know, you can say better than I what that involved and how far I think we've come since then. I mean, does it stand up?
Sure. This article was written shortly after the speech that she gave at Conservative Party conference in October 2016. And I was commenting really on the fact that she was bringing to Downing Street a set of principles, techniques of policy, an approach to power that had long listed, actually, it's long existed in the Home Office. And obviously she'd been Home Secretary for several years before becoming Prime Minister. And the Home Office is quite an interesting corner of Whitehall and has tended to be a rather embattled corner of Whitehall because while the Treasury and the Department of Business Innovation and Skills and so on have tended to celebrate free markets and openness and trade, and which includes high levels of immigration and so on, and that's the model of growth and an approach to economic policy that has dominated in Britain since Margaret Thatcher's time. Meanwhile, the Home Office has tended to be the part of the government that is more concerned with protecting people from whether it be crime or from various security threats, that tries to keep people out of the country, that in some ways represents the more fearful aspects of voter psychology and in some ways has a certain kind of sympathetic audience in the conservative tabloids. And in a way, what I was observing, or the starting point for the piece, was that Theresa May seem to embody aspects of that Home Office psychology and of that politics, in that she was, you know, her opening speech when she stood in Downing Street back in July of last year was that I am going to stand up for the powerless. I'm going to be the leader that is there to protect you from the various crosswinds of globalization and of capitalism to a great extent. I mean, she was identified as a leader that would move the Conservatives quite strongly to the left on economic policy. And so, what I was arguing in the piece was that she was, at least on a rhetorical level, was speaking as if she would act in a protective way, both in relation to social issues and to questions of and cultural issues, so quite a sort of nationalist agenda, but would also try and introduce a more protectionist approach to economic policy, which of course Brexit makes both inevitable in some ways, but also more possible.
Mm. I think the problem is that, or the striking thing is that that was very much the sort of politics she took into the election, I think. Certainly when I was recently rereading the sort of responses to that manifesto, I mean, it was, the Observer said she was an astonishing set of principles, watershed moment in British politics, and lots of other commentators took a similar line. So it's not that she abandoned the project, it seems that the voters rejected it, which seems still surprising, I suppose.
Yes, and I mean, I was one of many people who wrote some rather ill-fated lines about Theresa May's glorious future that lay ahead of her. And in that piece back in October of last year, I wrote that she might be in the process of constructing a project with even greater durability than Margaret Thatcher's. So it had about another sort of 6 months of hegemony left after I wrote that. So it did look as if there was something which was being assembled with quite a lot of durability, because she was making a very firm pitch to Labour voters. There was a whole narrative around the election of this year that the what was going to be so devastating for Labour was that, I think as Stephen Bush in The New Statesman wrote, that maybe voting UKIP was a kind of entry-level drug for voting Conservative. So there were various parts of the country that, particularly in South Wales and elsewhere, and in these kind of heavily Leave-oriented, Leave-voting areas such as the North East and so on, which had started to move away from Labour towards UKIP, had voted heavily in favour of Leave in June 2016, and that now they were had their sort of ears open to a potential appeal from the Conservative Party, if only the right kind of noises were being made about looking after you, for you and your family. We are still, you know, we care about the NHS, we care about jobs, we care about the family and so on. And this was what a general set of cultural economic concerns that had been summed up as red Tory for a while, or as blue Labour, that there was a kind of overlap between what were traditionally seen as left-wing economic policies with what had traditionally been seen as conservative social policies, and that some kind of, if you could pull these two things together, you could have a devastating electoral proposition. And it looked as if Theresa May was at least, you know, on a rhetorical level. I don't think she ever quite delivered. She never made it clear what the policies would be that would bring this to life. But at least on an ideological and rhetorical level, particularly influenced by her advisor, Nick Timothy, who was pretty much the first casualty on June 9th after the election. But he was the sort of one of the intellectual architects of this vision of a version of conservatism that would be pitched directly at working class and struggling lower middle class voters. And I think on a rhetorical and symbolic level, it made a lot of sense, but for various reasons, it started to fall apart. And I think one of the reasons it started to fall apart was that it was never clear how it would cash out in policy terms, in terms of actually making a difference to anyone's lives, other than to say that, I mean, people will always believe that the Conservative Party are going to be tougher on immigration than the Labour Party. And of course, people do care about immigration. But what positive difference is it going to make to anyone's life? That I don't think was ever made clear. I mean, maybe she called the election 6 months too early. Maybe she needed longer to start to actually develop a manifesto, because obviously the Conservative manifesto was one of the most woeful policy documents in living memory. I mean, it just didn't have anything in it. Not only did it not have any numbers in it, it didn't really have any policies in it. It was just a set of gestures and slogans, really. And quite who was responsible for that, I'm not quite sure, whether it was her advisors or Lyndon Crosby or whoever it might have been.
No, I completely agree that I think May's error was, to some extent, to stray so far into sort of Corbyn territory and yet offer such a weak policy option, that she'd gone so far as to identify a range of similar problems, agree actually to an extent with his analysis, and yet then allowed herself to be outbid on what she was offering. And I suppose what I was going to say is, I think it was a brilliant essay, by the way, and still worth reading. But what you certainly got right was the dynamics, I think, of the moment, because probably what was less easy to see at the time was that Corbyn was almost as well placed to tap into that moment as May was. And in fact, maybe, I think this was something I was going to ask you about anyway, is the extent to which Corbyn's politics could sort of fit alongside an idea of the protective state. I mean, you make a distinction between a protective state which discriminates and a care-oriented state which sort of recognises the population individually as humans deserving of particular standards of living. But there's, I suppose, a way of seeing a Corbynite economics which is protectionist, or is prepared to pick out sectors, or it's certainly prepared to abandon the sort of free market aspects of the EU that would hold back the sort of state aid rules and so forth.
Yes, I think Corbyn was able to inject hope into a similar agenda in a way that Mayism, whatever else it might have been, it's never been hopeful. It's never had any reason to believe that the future will be any better than the present. At its strongest, it might be able to convince people that it will be as good as the present, or even a more kind of sort of fantastical sense, perhaps as good as aspects of the past, some aspect of the 1950s or something like that. But it's never, at no point has Theresa May ever really convinced anybody that that after 5 years of a May government, things are going to be better than they are now. And that's partly because there are obviously various aspects of the reality Britain faces, including Brexit, including its precarious economic position, and so on, that mean that maybe, she doesn't believe that it will be better in 5 years' time. I think in some ways there's a kind of there's a sort of brute realism, perhaps, that maybe she and some of her advisors suffered from, which is they really felt they had very little room for manoeuvre to actually say anything very hopeful. Whereas in a way, I think what Corbyn was able to do by virtue of being the figure he is and clearly believing the things he believes was to, in a sense, sort of throw caution to the wind and say, we can spend more money. We can tax, we can raise more money from taxation. We can increase capital gains tax. We can raise income tax for the top earners and so on. And we can spend it on increasing the pay of nurses and teachers and this sort of thing. I mean, it's kind of, there's something kind of beautifully simple about it in a way. And it's been kind of a relatively obvious feature of social democracy for sort of 60 years. It's just that people had forgotten this quite. It was kind of dismissed as naive by under Blairism and so on, and not economically credible and not democratically credible and so on. But I think that Corbyn may have tapped into some similar sentiments, but I think he realised as well, whether he realised it or not, that it became clear that there was a yearning for something just a bit different, in a way of a sort that Theresa May was only ever offering to pull up the barricades in some way to protect us from Brexit, to reduce immigration, to protect us from Jeremy Corbyn. That was the most ridiculous aspect of the whole election, was that she called it and then spent the entire campaign saying, "I'm the only thing that can stop Jeremy Corbyn." It's like, well, if that was your biggest priority, you shouldn't have called the election. I mean, this is the absurdity of that whole campaign. Mm-hmm. Was that she was purely trying to act as this kind of Leviathan-like protector who was going to stand up for British interests, but she was the one who had caused the destabilisation of the election in the first place. Meanwhile, she never came across as a particularly, well, in her words, strong or stable figure. I mean, she often seemed rather fragile when it came to media appearances. She never seemed like a natural media operator. And I think these were some of the aspects of that campaign that did so badly for the Conservatives.
Mm. Meanwhile, and in another 5 years, a lot can change, and also another cohort of young voters coming in, which begs the question: what are the underlying dynamics that all the while are changing our politics? If the Brexit's the big structural issue, there's also a whole set of changes to do with the internet and the way people experience politics, which is something your second essay that we'll talk about today comes in. This essay called Reasons for Corbyn, where you sort of talk about the way the internet has acted as an archive, and by rendering visible people's pasts, individual politicians' pasts, it sort of elevated a new type of authenticity as a driving force in politics.
Yes, right? It's a really an analysis of the new type of leadership qualities that seem to thrive in this digital networked media environment. And one of the things that I argue in that piece is that the bottlenecks through which we used to encounter public figures and politicians no longer really exist. I mean, the bottlenecks used to be that newspapers were published once a day and you could buy them from a shop. And it used to be that politicians encountered the press via their press conferences or via the House of Commons and so on. And you'd watch the 6 o'clock news to find out what had happened that day and so on. And all of those kind of bottlenecks have basically been eradicated. And it's not just the bottlenecks of how we actually are able to encounter news and news content. It's also the bottlenecks of professional journalism and punditry and so on. And of course, part of the fallout from the June 8th election was immediately to start throwing a lot of questions towards our pundits and journalists, which was sort of strange in a way, because of course, it was odd how much it was thrown back as being a crisis for the media as much as anything else. I mean, it really should have. I mean, it was a crisis for the Conservative Party as much, first and foremost. But one of the things that it really did provoke, I think, in British public life was a discussion about, well, do journalists know anything anymore, and why do we even have pundits if their sort of lack of curiosity and their sort of lack of magnanimity means that they fail to spot something that is going on? And is there another way of spotting it that might actually be preferable and perhaps has nothing to do with newspapers at all, perhaps? I mean, could it be that, of course, there are questions about whether it's data analytics nowadays. I mean, there's people's views and feelings and so on are being collected in all sorts of new ways, which don't require the mediation of journalists and newspapers and so on. But I think that we are at a moment right now where it's really not clear what the status of newspapers and pundits and editors is in public life, whether they are to reflect something, whether they are to try and influence something, whether they are there to try and know something, because they don't seem to have necessarily done a very good job of any of those things over the last couple of years. And so that really raises the question of whether something else might come along instead. And I think the fact that Corbyn was able to do as well as he did without anybody appearing to know, other than YouGov, for various curious methodological reasons, and of course some of his really kind of passionate supporters kind of felt that something was going on. But of course, their evidence for that was normally like a photograph of a town hall meeting in a particular neighbourhood on a rainy Thursday evening. I mean, it doesn't necessarily tell you very much. I mean, it tells you something about the passions people feel, but it doesn't tell you anything much about how widely those passions are felt. So I think that it is an interesting moment in terms of that sort of crisis of a set of media institutions and elites that have had kind of ups and downs before. I mean, it's a bit like the what happened with the economics profession, or then perhaps not enough happened with that after the financial crisis, where everyone wanted to know, well, wasn't it your job to see this kind of thing coming? And I think that's been in many ways one of the more significant fallouts from June the 8th is the questions it's raised for the media.
Mm. I think we've become very anxious about post-truth, and Brexit seemed to vindicate this idea of a post-truth moment where, the 350 million figure can get bandied around for the NHS and everyone knows it's not true, but it doesn't seem to make any difference. And I think we felt anxious after Brexit because Brexit was a tabloid policy that had been, the ground had been prepared for a long time, so it seemed. And it seemed to vindicate a lot of things people feel, perhaps not entirely consciously, which is that, people who read the tabloids believe what they read there. And I think there's a lot to do with class in that response, that willingness to ascribe naivety or a lack of discrimination to people who read the Sun or the Mail. But I think what's actually been proved since the election is that we were all living in a post-truth moment, that the tabloids had no objectivity, but neither really did The Guardian or The Observer. And really, we need to be much more relaxed about embracing a new politics where the information that is available to people is segmented and comes from different sources and can be subjective and partisan in a way that we've been told the news can't be, and that we should be much more optimistic about the way that enables a politics which is no longer structured around the press in what has become a very unhealthy relationship, I think, between the Westminster elite and Fleet Street, and that we should be cautiously optimistic about a politics which can no longer be defined by the nature of that relationship, which is, I think, what you what you were being cautiously optimistic about as well.
Yes, I think that the cynicism toward I think everyone's realised that we live in a kind of age of cynicism towards politics. This has been something that has become a sort of truism over decades, really. But I think people perhaps underestimated how cynical people were towards newspapers. I mean, it's actually, if you look at the surveys on trust, which are things that get studied quite a lot, that politicians and journalists are right up there with estate agents and other of the less trusted professions. And so I think that there's been a lot of cynicism towards the press for some time, and I think people have often underestimated that because they've always assumed that if there's anything rotten in public life, it probably stems from our political classes, and forgetting that actually people are just as sick of you know, particularly around the hacking scandal and so on. I mean, disgusting behaviour of causing people harm in an effort to try and create sensationalist news. And I think that people, I mean, one of the things, as you argue in your piece, that people, particularly those who have liberal left sympathies, have tended to look at the tabloid media as being this kind of all-powerful monster that can basically control sort of mass movements and political sympathy and voting habits and so on, which of course The Sun has always wanted to kind of give off that impression, particularly with its famous 1992 headline of "The Sun, what won it?" But I think that perhaps we've overestimated the power of these institutions and underestimated how sick of them many people are. And I think that the other thing which your piece introduces in the question of what are the alternatives, because people can't live in a sort of entirely sort of newsless world. I mean, they can't. People need to have some means of trying to understand what's going on in their society and in their lives and so on. And I thought what was quite interesting was the possibility that you explore of there being some other types of gatekeepers. We might not necessarily see them as gatekeepers because they don't have a big kind of, you know, they're not professional necessarily. They're not necessarily paid. They don't have this kind of institutional quality of the sort that Fleet Street had. But I thought that was quite interesting to think about how that might play out and how it may have played out in the 2017 election.
Yeah. This is these people who, you know, there's this chap called Thomas Clark in Yorkshire. He's a blogger. He has a page on Facebook called Another Angry Voice. I mean, I saw his stuff during the election without really realising where it was coming from. And he's sort of churning out these pro-Corbyn, you know, well-sourced articles, but pro-Corbyn articles. One alone went viral to the extent that it was read as many times as The Sun was on any given day. And in general, his articles received millions of reads. But there's also one of the other interesting things is how many just members of the public, you know, would just put together a meme of an evening and it would, you know, be shared, you know, 26,000 times or whatever, and it would reach 2.9 million people. I mean, that's what the internet has enabled is a new system of publicity, new system of mass communication, which sort of until now, really, the press had a monopoly on. I mean, the press and democracy went sort of developed together in the sense that, you know, in the late 19th century, it became clear to politicians that mass democracy could only work if you had a system of publicity that allowed the public and their governors to sort of see each other and interact, if even only virtually. And it's only now that we can see that the internet actually is finally created a sort of rival ecosystem which provides those conditions of publicity which still allow democracy to function but offer an alternative power structure, a much more democratic one.
And I think the other interesting thing about that is that it clearly has a capacity to mobilise, in a sense that political scientists, particularly of a more quantitative persuasion, more interested in sort of the kind of economics of voting behaviour and the sort of individual rationality of voting behaviour, have often sort of, you know, treated democracy as a big kind of set of collective action problems, which is, well, I might want communism or something else, but I don't think anybody else does, so I'm going to carry on voting Labour because I'll do what I think collectively is possible. And that becomes quite narrowed by looking at things like polling data, by listening to the objective political reports from the BBC or CNN and so on. So in a sense, these traditional liberal media, in a way, have a kind of dampening effect on what otherwise might be quite sort of niche political views. But of course, one of the things that these other media outlets can do, the ones that you're talking about, is that they can generate bubbles, and bubbles are generally seen as sort of negative thing. I mean, you don't want to live in a media bubble where all you ever hear is views that reinforce your own. But of course, bubbles also have a kind of mobilizing power, and they are good ways of overcoming collective action problems, which is that you can, that if I look around me on Facebook and everybody believes that we can, you know, renationalize the banks, or we can, resurrect the British Empire, or whatever it might be, is that it becomes possible to actually, you could say that these things are not realistic in their origins, but they can become realistic because they have a kind of mobilizing effect. They can generate their own realism, in a sense. They can become more plausible in a way that they're not plausible when you live in a world purely of looking at the opinion polls and what the broad policy menu is across the UK at large. But they have the capacity to create enthusiasm and to create excitement and to overcome their lack of plausibility. And I think there's something about that. That's not to say that Corbynism is based on implausible policies. I think, in a sense, the what was brilliant, I think, about the Labour campaign of over the course of April, May, June of this year was that when they kind of unveiled the manifesto, and it turned out that the manifesto contained some quite carefully worked out, quite plausible, reasonably sensible, but nevertheless quite hopeful policies, and clearly a lot of work had gone into it, I think that actually was a kind of key moment where actually a lot of this the sort of bubbles of enthusiasm had the capacity to actually turn into something more than that. But I do think that given that Corbyn managed to survive for 2 years under fire, almost 2 years under fire, as seen as an utterly implausible leader, and basically people had sort of dismissed him completely out of hand, which is obviously what the kind of pundit class had done, I think that those pockets and those bubbles of you know, you could say they're self-reinforcing, and you could say what you like about them. There's lots of, it's easy to be critical of them, but they have a political potential which I think needs to be taken seriously, because after all, democracy is in some ways not about being realistic. Democracy is about mobilization, and actually often too many facts and too much hard evidence it only dampens the sentiments that lead people to get involved in political campaigns.
Yeah, that's an interesting question about policy, because you know, the Corbyn campaign, it was fairly straightforward social democratic ambitions, you know, the sort of thing. Yes, you know, in the sort of 30-year context, maybe striking departures, but generally still quite sort of small c conservative in their ambitions. But what you're saying here is that sort of big, far-reaching, dramatic reform, sort of big policy ideas can now start not only just be built up in these sort of bubbles, but can then sort of possibly achieve a takeoff.
Yes, I mean the point I was making in the piece was that the Labour manifesto was clearly crucial. I mean the Corbyn surge from kind of roughly around about 27% in the polls up to where he ended up, which was just over 40% in the actual result, happened pretty soon after the unveiling of the manifesto, and all sorts of extraordinary things started to change. I mean, the South Wales, which had been one of the most depressing stories for Labour supporters, was watching the polls were showing that Labour was going to lose South Wales, which is the absolute heartland and where the origins of the Labour Party lie. The manifesto was what started to sort of turn things around. And I think what was interesting, if I was a political strategist or a campaigner thinking about the lessons from this campaign in future, is that you need to have some hopeful policies that work on a symbolic level as well as on a technical level. I mean, Corbyn was unveiling policies of a sort that were easy to comprehend. They were not that easy to pull apart. They weren't that easy to misrepresent. They were things, I mean, a lot of them were just basic fiscal aspects of social democracy, such as putting up capital gains tax to pay for free tuition and this sort of thing. But, you know, no tax rises for 95% of earners and this sort of thing. And I think that this can operate in a sort of viral fashion. I mean, it's a completely different style of campaigning as to what New Labour were both very good at, but also rather kind of disliked for by the end, which was this rather paranoid attempt to try and control every piece of message. Whereas Corbynism, partly by virtue of the fact that isn't even in control, really, of at the time wasn't really in control of the Parliamentary Labour Party, let alone in control of the media. So in a way, it had to operate as more of a sort of guerrilla movement of unleashing policies, of trusting that the supporters were going to have to do a lot of legwork. And I think Momentum did do a lot of very important work for Corbyn. But in some ways it's more of a viral movement, more of a decentralised phenomenon. And it's actually very difficult to campaign against, because if you're still using traditional campaigning techniques of trying to send out rigidly controlled messages in a very sort of linear kind of monologue of the sort that Theresa May was doing, if in response you're getting this kind of sort of more kind of guerrilla warfare style decentralized messaging, where you've got policies that can zip around and be receive a lot of enthusiasm because ultimately they were positive policies, I think that it's a different way of conducting a campaign. Now, how you then use any of those sorts of tactics once you're in power is a rather different question. And I think that's, remains one of the big problems for politicians and for governments around the world.
I think actually it confirms something, the sort of Corbyn effect confirms something that I've thought for a while and argued in my previous life as an academic, which is that celebrity, or the sort of apparatus of celebrity, the mechanisms of celebrity, can be sort of profoundly pro-democratic in their effects. We tend to think of, or when people dismiss Corbyn and dismiss the sort of hysteria or excitement he generates, people tend to say, oh, it's a personality cult, or, it's a load of gullible students, or it's somehow antithetical to British traditions. But really, that sort of connection, that sort of imagined relationship between a public figure and an ordinary member of the public can be actually a really effective way of mobilising democratic activity and engaging people in politics, and that actually grounding things in the personal is a really useful way of mobilising people. Again, this is something that the new media, the internet, Twitter, Facebook, enables more than previously, this sense of a direct connection. And in fact, it is much more of a direct connection than it ever was before. And part of the problem, I think, previously is that some of those tactics and tools that were very effective 100 years ago in terms of building this sort of relationship between governors and governed, politicians and the electorate, the speech, the photo call, the portrait, things that seemed initially sort of liberating and exciting in their effects in terms of generating a new sort of democratic politics, gradually sort of calcified and became, clearly exploitative. And I think that sort of probably reached its peak in the new Labour years, which is probably now where we're finally seeing this sort of reaction against it. And what Twitter and Facebook provide is a new way of doing that sort of politics, which actually is much less open to and control. Alistair Campbell couldn't do quite the same thing with this set of tools as he could with the old ones. And it feels much more plausible as a sort of form of interaction and a connection.
I suppose, one of the questions that comes out of this is, what does this mean for the future of political leadership? Because one of the things I pointed out in my piece on Corbyn was how I suppose it's interesting how Trump, Sanders and Corbyn, it's a kind of banal point in a way, but how old they all are by the standards of recent political leaders, where the standard third way politician in the 1990s was a man in his early 40s, and Macron is 39, so he kind of fits the type quite closely. And it was sort of assumed after Blair that you had to have these kind of Cameron or David Miliband or Ed Miliband or Nick Clegg or one of these kind of figures, and they all sort of began to blur into one after a while, which is part of the problem. But now there's a kind of the Sanders Trump Corbyn phenomenon of these men around the age of 70. And I suggest in the piece that they have these long biographies of being just on the edge of public life. I mean, they're sort of people who have been known about, and it's possible to go and research if you wanted to. It's not just research. You don't have to kind of like type into Google or Google image search or whatever, but find out, who they are, what they stand for. And I use the example of the fact that both Corbyn and Sanders have a widely circulated photograph of themselves being dragged away by police from, in Corbyn's case, it was an anti-apartheid protest in the early 80s, and in Sanders Rogers' case, it was a civil rights march in the early 1960s, and this, in a way, you know, they were on the right side of history. This is kind of what gives them a kind of moral authority. And so this is, I think, there's something. I know Trump is a completely different kind of kettle of fish, but again, I mean, people have known who Donald Trump is in American society for 20, 30 years or so. I mean, he's been you know, rather laughed at by people who are not likely to vote Republican, but he's embodied something that people that his supporters would have respected throughout that time. So they have a good archive behind them in that sense, as my piece is arguing. I think one of the questions, though, is what does this mean in the future? Because say Clive Lewis became the next leader of the Labour Party, for instance, or if people are saying, I mean, Jacob Rees-Mogg's probably still a joke, but there has been this talk of Jacob Rees-Mogg becoming the next leader of the Conservative Party.
Mogmentum,
ready for Rees-Mogg, as the website has it. But people are saying, you know, the next leader of the Tory Party will be someone who we haven't even heard of yet. This is the claim. How will they, you know, maintain that sort of leadership quality in the face of this kind of constantly swirling? I mean, is it possible to just stand back and not try and control the news agenda? Well, not completely if you're prime minister. But I think that one thing that leaders will have to try and do if they're to survive in this environment is to treat, I suppose, the press a bit like the way someone would treat a troll on the internet, which is to not. There's an expression which is "don't feed the troll." Mm. So if someone's on Twitter and they're sort of trying to misrepresent you and attack you and make jokes at you and so on, the phrase "don't feed the troll" means you basically have to ignore them, because otherwise you're just simply giving more attention to them and to the arguments they're making. And that we live in an attention economy, and actually just ignoring one's critics is the best way of waiting for the criticism to subside, which is a complete anathema to the sort of Blairite kind of news cycle obsessed media management mentality, which is that, well, what are we going to say at 2 p.m. and has it worked by 3 p.m. and, you know, this constant sort of react sort of mentality.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's the thing about, you know, plurality in the media that wasn't there before, is exactly that it allows someone like Corbyn to sort of, in a way, take a step back, and you let other people do the work for you. A lot of the work that someone like Tony Blair had to do to stay in the media, to do all those interviews, to make the speeches, to appear in front of the cameras, Corbyn doesn't have to do in quite the same way anymore, because he can rely on this sort of digital army of people circulating images of him, quotes, videos. So he can sort of ration his appearances and allow other people to pick up the slack, as it were. And because Fleet Street media doesn't have that stranglehold, that bottleneck, as you put it, any longer, you can afford, as he did, to ignore, you know, everyone apart from the Daily Mirror, which you probably don't even, you know, it's nice to give them a column every now and again, but, you know, even they're not crucial. And actually you can let other people do the work in other parts of the sort of digital ecosystem, and so, that there's a freedom there, isn't there?
What I was going to ask was, so I mean, if there were a future over the next couple of years where the Brexit talks run into all sorts of problems, where, as everyone's predicting will happen, the DUP are no longer prepared to prop up Theresa May's government, and the various alternatives to Theresa May as leader can't manage to work things out between themselves, and you get a general election, which I think there are still a lot of people who think it will happen in the autumn. And let's say after all of this happens, we have Jeremy Corbyn as the next prime minister. Mm. Does any of the kind of media support or media landscape that you're describing in your piece, how does any of that work once the figure who is the sort of centerpiece of a lot of that enthusiasm is the prime minister getting their hands dirty with difficult problems? I mean, the only real, to use the examples we've used so far, the only precedent we have for that is the rather unfortunate one of Donald Trump, whose presidency is going absolutely nowhere at the moment, and his ratings are very, very bad. But I assume that, I mean, things like the Canary and some of the other alternative media outlets that are sympathetic to Corbyn would still be around once he was in Downing Street and once John McDonnell was in the Treasury, and there would be a huge amount of resistance to that from within the state, and a huge amount of resistance that from the Murdoch press. Does any of that stuff will that stuff come to their aid, do you think?
Yeah, I don't, well, exactly. I mean, I just was just referring to his freedom, and that's exactly what he would lose as a political figure, as a political leader. I suppose, first of all, we hope he's good at politics, or we, at least we, you know, if someone like me who's sort of cautiously optimistic about the new media age, I still don't for a moment think that you don't no longer need to be good at politics. And so you'd still hope that there's the level of political skill there and sophistication of political thinking that would allow there to be a fairly successful operation run from Downing Street, both on a policy level in terms of the sort of practicalities of doing politics, but also that you would have to obviously have a sensible way of dealing with the media that exists. So that it wouldn't be that you put out what you want to put out, and you try not to sort of slavishly follow the tabloid agenda in the way that the Blair government was guilty of doing too often.
Yeah.
And also that you think that maybe this other sort of media, the new media, is maybe reaching a degree of maturity, or, you know, I think actually we've seen that sort of media develop very quickly in the last few years when you think about some of the platforms that exist now that didn't 5 years ago, and that actually that would be a growing part of politics, a more powerful dimension to politics than it is now, and that it could be an alternative power base, that it could offer support that wasn't available in the mainstream media, and that and those messages could reach, you know, huge numbers of people, more people than the press could reach, and that the same dynamics that were at work in the election in terms of allowing Corbyn to rehabilitate his image and spread the message of the manifesto, those same dynamics, providing everything was going okay in 10 Downing Street, providing there are things to be proud of or pleased about, that those same dynamics could spread a positive message and counteract whatever was being said by the Murdoch press. I don't know how plausible that is, but that would presumably be... Does that strike you as sensible?
No, I mean, I think there is the... I mean, this is the big question. I mean, are these alternative platforms and news outlets, are they just insurgents, or can they be
the
institutions? Yes, and can they support the kind of public realm that people have tried to defend since the 18th century, or are they just there to try and disrupt that public realm and to try and carve it up into little pieces? Clearly, that what's called the alt-right is only interested in the latter, really, because they view the very idea of the public realm as a kind of liberal conspiracy that benefits certain professional classes and so on. I think that, I suppose, the Blairite, a lot of the Blairite animosity towards the media derived from the fact that they didn't feel that their successes were ever adequately communicated. And they, a lot of Blairites, a lot of the people who worked around Blair were policy wonks, basically. And they had, I mean, a lot of them viewed the world in quite an economistic, quite statistical kind of way.
Which is why that generation of politicians was so unsatisfactory, I think. You know, the Milibands and the Purnells and the Burnhams and...
Yeah. But they also feel that they, you know, that the in terms of the effect of the Blair government on child poverty, the fall of inequality during the second term, the huge amounts of money put into the NHS, the redistribution of tax credits and so on, they just feel utterly kind of unfairly represented. But I suppose part of the problem was that, I mean, something like tax credits gets to the heart of what didn't work as a media strategy from New Labour's new media strategy, which is that tax credits are so complicated, even the people who receive them barely understand how they work, and often they don't even know they've received them because it all happened via the pay packet and so on. So they completely dropped the ball when it came to the symbolic aspect of politics and the elements of politics which are about the visible and the mutually understood and the things that we can all see that something has happened here, because for that, you know, they looked at the world slightly through spreadsheets and then couldn't understand when these bloody journalists didn't then go and communicate these wonderful success stories. And of course there were these figures like Polly Toynbee and others who have sort of tried to kind of straddle the world of a kind of statistical discourse and a journalistic discourse of trying to act as the, to try and communicate some of those success stories. But ultimately, I mean, you can't expect journalists to become statisticians and to become evidence-based policymakers. And I think that was how a lot of that relationship went sour. I mean, apart from things like the financial crisis and so on. But and I suppose the risk is with Corbynism is that it could end up making the opposite mistake in a way. Is that it could at least in the sort of space that you're describing play some very, very clever symbolic cards. But what is going to happen to the question of evidence-based policy of technocracy, basically, in the future? Of course, people don't like technocrats anymore. We don't want these experts and these elites to take all these decisions for us. We don't see what they know that we don't know, and so on. But ultimately, if Corbyn were to form a government, and for that government to actually achieve some social good, there will need to be, you know, the symbolic and the utilitarian will need to be kind of married to get together once again. And I think that's one of the anxieties I still have about some of that. And I think that the more pessimistic take on that, the more, I mean, you might even say paranoid take on that, is that in the media landscape that you're describing in your piece, if some of the worst fears of a sort of post-truth media were to come true, then speaking about the facts and the evidence, the statistics, and so on, becomes just one perspective amongst many. That's the sort of, you know, how it's, that's the fear of that's the fear that animates, for instance, the New York Times right now, or something like this. Is that, you know, in America, that as soon as you say, well, actually, the facts are these and the stats say this, oh, it's like, oh, you're an East Coast liberal. You know, that this is now just one, you're a centrist. This is now just one perspective amongst many. And are we, you know, is there the risk of these, some of these kind of online platforms that you're talking about, and also the way in which we can get our news content filtered for us via Facebook, which is where most people read online newspapers, is via their Facebook feed, not via the website itself. You know, what is there to actually kind of prop up some idea of the objective state of society and economy?
Yeah, I do. As I have two thoughts immediately on that subject, which is A, that I think, and this isn't what you're saying, but I think when people talk in those terms, there is often that sense that as if we've sort of left the golden age behind when people didn't think that, you know, various bits of information were bits of information amongst many that they could pick and choose from. And I think people have always chosen to believe what they want to believe and ignore certain things that counteract what they already believe. And that those people have always existed. People have never voted on purely rational grounds, or their party allegiance has never been purely rational. It's just part of the way the internet's changed our politics is that we can hear people much better. So we can hear ordinary people much better, and it's much easier for someone to pick up on someone they perceive as stupid or idiotic and then share that tweet and it goes round, and, you know, and this and that sums up a Trump supporter, for example. And I'm optimistic enough that, you know, lots of people, you know, don't think like that, or that people are open to change their mind. And actually the internet allows people to, as much as it can herd people into small groups, it also allows people to accidentally stumble into another group or stumble across a piece of information they didn't see before, and that's possible too. But the second thing, just to respond to your point about the sort of technocratic aspects of politics, is that if tax credits didn't find their spokesman, as it were, in the press before, maybe it's possible that, you know, in the new media, Twitter, blogosphere, if we still talk about the blogosphere, there are people who are interested in making that case, and that people who were, you know, were never, you know, in the headquarters of The Sun, but are sat somewhere else and actually can find a way of communicating tax credits in a positive, comprehensible way, that the internet does actually enable those sorts of people to come to the fore, and that sort of information can possibly, feasibly circulate in ways that it couldn't in the past.
Sure.
And that maybe actually, there is also the possibility that it's not just symbolic policy that can work online, but also that sort of more technical stuff can be seized by someone with a mission, like our friend Thomas Clark in New Yorkshire, someone who could actually find a way of popularising that information, the information people need to know.
There are these interesting blogging economists and public intellectuals, people like Chris Dillow, has a blog called stumblingandmumbling.com, which is a brilliant he's very regular blogger, but he provides always a very thought-provoking, quite chatty analysis, but with lots of links to economic papers and evidence that you could actually go and follow up on. And it's quite a skill, and not many people can do it. But I think it's interesting that there is now a different type of way in which the different types of punditry can emerge, which potentially can be more loyal to a kind of ideal of expert objectivity rather than less, actually, because, you know, I'd rather listen to what Chris Dillow told me about what's going on in the economy than, certainly than Richard Littlejohn or someone who makes hundreds of thousands of pounds a year for saying incendiary things. So I think that, yes, there's various different developments in this space, and we need to, I think what's helpful about your analysis is that you focus on the positive rather than the explosively negative.
Well, there you go. I do my best. I just thought we'd finish just maybe one final question, which is one of the things that is interesting about what you've done in the LRB is that you've, in your two sort of interpretative essays, it's a way of writing about politics that is actually quite rare still, and it's risky, as most writing on politics is. But I wondered if you had any thoughts about what it's like to write about politics in our current moment and the challenges and possibilities of doing that.
Well, my own background is in sociology. I mean, my PhD is in sociology, I think that sociology is the sort of discipline that when everything's going absolutely fine, people think, oh, it's just a bunch of guys with beards and using lots of abstract language. But
I should point out that Will does have.
But actually, I think when crises strike, it becomes useful to be able to place events such as Brexit and the turbulence, the political turbulence of the last year, but also the turbulence of the last decade since the financial crisis, into a much longer historical and conceptual sweep and to place it on a much larger canvas. And I think that I suppose all I try to do is to locate events in what to me are hopefully understandable longer term processes, trends, and so on, which in relation to my own writings, one thing which people sometimes say to me about pieces I've written is that they're reassuring, which I find kind of strange in a way, given they're generally sort of discussing some quite kind of potentially quite depressing events sometimes. But I think what that's alluding to is the fact that it locates what appears to be exceptional, unprecedented, contingent in a history and in a context which demonstrates that it's actually it can be those things, it's not beyond our comprehension.
Yeah.
And I think that one of the problems with a lot of political writing, and this is what I think the pundits are guilty of in relation to the election, and a problem with a lot of our social science, is that it's become more and more fixated on the personal and the local and the individual. So in social science, I mean, you think of things like the rise of behavioral economics and obsession with neuroscience and why do we take this decision, not that decision, and so on. And equally, pundits who think that politics begins and ends within Westminster. I think that everything is about strategies between is Boris going to beat David Davis or is David Davis going to do this? And actually what I think people hopefully are interested in right now, I hope my pieces are interesting, but I hope that to the extent that they are, I think it's because I try to actually look at what's outside of that frame that has become a sort of dominant one, in an age of celebrity and an obsession with the intricacies and the mechanics of individual politics of strategy and decision making and behavior and so on. And actually, I think that's what sociology and in other traditions of cultural studies and so on can bring if when the moment strikes.
Yeah, and in fact, that might be another sort of unsuspected legacy of Corbyn, that by creating that disjuncture, by sort of making a clear break with the sort of neoliberal consensus, that actually he's opened up sort of discursive space around politics that wasn't there before. Because if there's a level of consensus on how the economy works and how the economy should work, then actually it's much easier just to talk about machinations at Westminster, because that is the big change. That is, those are the sort of dynamic factors. And by breaking with that, you sort of relocate attention elsewhere. And I think actually when you think about what does do the rounds on Twitter in sort of leftist circles, it is much now more now about structural questions about pay, about housing, about the economy than it is about personalities. And obviously personalities is a useful way of communicating those messages, but it does feel like the spotlight has shifted to some of those bigger structural concerns. Yeah. So I think that's a good place to end. Thank you.
The LRB podcast is sponsored by Art and Ideas, a podcast series featuring J. Paul Getty Trust President Jim Cuno in conversation with artists, writers, curators and scholars. In the latest episode, Ankar Mühlstein, author of The Pen and the Brush, How Passion for Art Shaped 19th Century French Novels, discusses the symbiotic relationship between authors and artists in 19th century France. Search Getty Art and Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or other podcast sources.